The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is New Zealander Eleanor Catton, who won the 2013 Man Booker Prize for her novel, The Luminaries. The 700-page tome is a rip-roaring adventure set in New Zealand's 19th century gold rush and is written in a style which has the feel of a Victorian novel. But it's a novel that works on several different levels, as book club host John Mullen pointed out. What had particularly confounded the critics, he thought, was the astrology mentioned at the opening of every chapter. So does one need to understand astrology to read the book properly?
Well, my hope is that you don't, but if you did, it would reward you in a very different way. You know, it would reward a second reading, essentially. That was my intention with the book. First and foremost, that it would read like an adventure story, a mystery with a kind of a grand reveal, a courtroom scene. I really wanted a courtroom scene. Blackmails, schemes that go awry, schemes that go right, you know. You could read it on a plot level purely for enjoyment. That was really important. One of the things that was kind of on my mind when I was beginning to dream about the book was how often literary fiction, quote-unquote literary fiction, tends to be very difficult and to kind of resist pleasing the reader or entertaining the reader, and that there's a sense that you have to kind of dutifully read it, and when your mind starts straying, you have to kind of bring your mind back and apply yourself to the reading. And I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to see if I could write something that was fun, that gave all of the pleasures of a book for children or a genre fiction book, but at the same time it was literary in the sense of being attentive of the nuances and subtleties of human psychology, you know. So that was one level, but at the same time I wanted to see if I could build into the book another level of meaning that would reward a second reading. One of the things that I really love about reading murder mysteries is that there's the sense at the very beginning of the book that the author has made things incredibly inconvenient for themselves in order for it to be very entertaining for you. So I wanted to do all of that, but at the same time I wanted to see if I could have this other level of meaning going on. There's more going on than your experience of the book, that there are these forces at work that maybe you can't know about in their entirety. The book as a whole is bigger than your experience of it. That to me is the experience of looking at the night sky, especially once you know a tiny little bit about the zodiac. You start seeing the patterns and the harmonies and kind of everything at work, and it's quite a vertiginous feeling, I think. Like, it makes you feel really like you're on the edge of the galaxy looking in. So I kind of wanted to try and do both of those things at once, but to answer your question, I think that the most important thing for me always was the plot. And I knew that at any point, if I had to choose between the plot and the structure, the plot would win. And there are several points at which I kind of bent what I found astrologically in order to suit the plot.
How do you mean? Did you sort of look up? Did you find out what the positions of the heavens were, as it were, in the year that you were writing about, for the date? And that's possible to do, is it?
It is, yes. Yeah. I use two computer programs, actually. The first one is on a website, starandtelescope.com, which is an astronomy magazine, a periodical. You can put in the latitude and longitude of anywhere on Earth and also a date. And I discovered to my joy, the date you can put in can go right back to around about 500 BC. This is amazing. And it not only shows you the placement of all the planets, but also the phases of the moon and all sorts of fun stuff. And so what I did in putting the novel together is, first of all, went to this program and plugged in the date when gold was first discovered in Hokitika, which was the middle of the year in 1864. And watched the sky for the whole period of the gold rush, so right through to about 1868, and took notes of everything that I saw, and then looked at the notes and thought, where do I want to begin?
Right.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, I don't recommend
and
it.
And so, and...
it's kind of a...
But the charts... Okay. Now, I'm going to be thick here, but the charts...
Yeah.
The 12 men in the room at the beginning, they, each one of them corresponds to a sign of the zodiac.
That's correct.
So, do the charts kind of tell you who you're going to read about and what the... Yeah, they
do. Yes, exactly. So this is for part one, and you can see, if you know the glyphs of all of the planetary signs, which I can assume you all do, because this is a book club, hooray.
And that chart is true to the date of...
Yes, actually, I've taken a lot of liberties with a lot of historical events in New Zealand. And in many ways, this isn't a historical novel at all, because it doesn't really involve any actual New Zealand events of the time. But it is historical in the sense that the star charts are all accurate.
So does that mean that actually there were occasions when the star charts told you what characters to put in and where to put them and who to put them with?
Yes and no. I had chosen the path of the book quite deliberately. In New Zealand, at these latitudes, Mercury sets after the summer. And so I thought, I can use that. I can begin with Moody, this newcomer into this environment, walking into a kind of a murder mystery setup. And then I can have him exit at the point when Mercury would set. And that'll kind of be his whole involvement in the story. So his arc was there from the very beginning. I'm very excited, actually. I feel very excited because I can never talk about the book in this way.
I mean, it must have been hard enough to plot it without these 19th century star signs saying, no, you can't have this guy here. He's got to be in a different place.
I chose it very deliberately, and I always knew where I was going to go back in time, back to 1865. So before I even began writing, I had a very general sense of where the planets were going to move, you know. I knew, for example, that Venus at this point was a morning star. You know, Venus alternates being a morning star and evening star. And because it was a morning star, it was following the sun pretty much through the whole of the Gold Rush, really, which meant that my two female characters, because at the beginning of the book, Anna has kind of become the sun, which I've never been able to say in front of an audience before. She's kind of swapped places with Emery Staines. This kind of cosmically happens when they sleep together.
Yeah.
Again, I've never been able to say. Which they do at the end of the book, which is obviously also just before the beginning. There's this kind of thematic axis in the book that I see as being between love and money. Mm. And this idea that you can't buy love. And at the same time, you can never truly love money. It doesn't make sense to love money for itself. And in a way, I see all of the action of the book strung out on this axis. And I had Anna, who as a prostitute was obviously dealing with this in a very real way, where all of the zodiacal characters in the book, by frequenting her and paying for her company, are, you know, engaged in a transactional relationship with her, confusing the transactional of money with the completely untransactional condition of love. And I think that what Lydia offers the book is the chance to do that same thing, but with fortune, with the idea of fate, rather than with the individual, which kind of Anna is. She's open about the fact that she is a swindler, but also open about the fact that actually, in order to know the future, that is the ultimate swindle anyway.
Can I ask you about one thing? She makes a big thing about how February is a month without...
A moon.
The moon.
This was another thing that drew me to beginning the book in this year and on this precise date. The cycle of the moon is just over 28 days. And because February is a short month and of 28 days, there is this phenomenon that astrologers call a month without a moon, where you have a full moon on the last day of January and then a full moon on the first day of March. And so there's no full moon in February. I really wanted to begin the book with a disappearance. One of the writers who is really important to me is Philip Pullman, and I think that he's brilliant at handling disappearances. It's such a great force at the beginning of a mystery, because when somebody disappears, they can't tell you why they've gone, you know. So it's immediately you've got a good setup. And so I had known about the month without a moon that was going to happen in this year.
What, Emery is the moon? And
by this point he is.
Yes.
Yeah, so that to me kind of made sense of the fact. See, the problem is with a disappearance in a book where you're using horoscopes is that none of the planets ever truly disappear. They're always there in some way.
And just to make it a bit more interesting, you also do of having chapters which get shorter as you go through. They halve each time, pretty much.
They do, yeah. Yes. And I can actually now, again, because this is a book club and I'm allowed to reveal secrets, I can reveal what I thought was this hilarious joke in the novel that everyone who I've told this to has just been completely deadpan and said that it's not a joke and it's not even funny. But the fortune that once it's eventually valued by the bank, comes to £4,096, which is 2 to the power 12. So if you halve and halve and halve that fortune again, which as it does happen in the book, that's how it gets halved, you end up with one, which I think is really great. But anyway, that's kind of a bit of a secret tidbit.
God.
I mean, this is the most silly aspect of the structure, I think. And the one that I knew that if I couldn't make it work, I would just jettison it.
Right.
I mean, all of...
But why is it important to make it? Well, why, if it was foolish, why did you need it?
Well, I think that it's to do with, again, to do with love and money. You know, it's possible to have money again and again and again and end up with nothing. That's usually what happens to most fortunes. And so, yeah, I wanted to make a comment on that law of diminishing returns. But also, you know, because the book ends in this scene of intimacy, that is something that is indivisible. There's this idea of, you know, when you're in love with a person, that you feel doubled when you're in their presence and halved when you're out of their presence.
There must have been a bit of working backwards in order to make this work.
Some of it, yes. A surprising amount of it, no. You're reading the finished document. You know, you're not seeing everything that's on the cutting room floor, and you weren't there for all of the dead ends. So, for example, I knew absolutely from the very beginning that I wanted to have a courtroom scene in the book. And the reason for that was that I'd read The Brothers Karamazov, and I'd loved it. And I just really like courtroom scenes that kind of operate in that way, where you get this kind of grand reveal.
When you're reading it, you're aware of quite a lot of, and everybody sort of comments on it, you do this omniscient voice, this first-person plural pronoun, which is very unusual to get in contemporary fiction, but you get in kind of, you get it in George Eliot and things. We know, we see.
I was very worried about using the omniscient third. You know, I was determined to use it, partly because it was one of the things that I was really noticing about contemporary fiction, that it's the one way of telling a story that's completely out of fashion these days, and it was so widely used in earlier centuries. And that got me thinking, why? You know, why is it that not only are we so reluctant to use the omniscient third and so suspicious of it when it appears? I mean, if you go back to the 19th century, first of all, everybody was white, public school educated, and who went to Oxbridge and all that kind of stuff. It starts just narrowing and narrowing until you realise that the novelists are actually occupying a very small, like relative to the whole, a very small segment of the human experience. But that started really bothering me because I started thinking, well, why is it that when an aristocratic person from England in the 19th century uses the omniscient third, that's okay. But when a kind of a upstart from New Zealand in the 21st century uses it, it's not okay. Like, what does that say to us about where we position the idea of a cosmic voice? I feel, I should say, that it's a voice that should be reclaimed by people who haven't traditionally used it. One of the things that led me to this inquiry of the omniscient third person, actually, was a feeling that I've had for a number of years, partly because I'm a product, I suppose, of the creative writing school system. I went to school at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the United States and also did a master's in New Zealand. And something that really started to bother me at, you know, which you find quite a bit in creative writing schools, is the violence with which people talk about the adverb. People very often say this, they say, cull your adverbs. They're never talking about adverbs like the word soon or like the word tomorrow or yet. They're talking about words like superciliously or...
Lugubriously.
Lugubriously, exactly. Yes. They're always polysyllabic, usually Latinate words that end in an L-Y. Yeah. And I started to think about this and in kind of my slightly defensive way, defensively, I started to think about defensively, and I started thinking about what an adverb really is. And the ideas that I kind of lit upon is that if I were to say right now describe you and say, John sat pensively. There's this kind of uneasiness about this pensively, the word pensively, because you might not actually be feeling particularly pensive. I might just be giving you that. You know, I might be seeing that when it's not there. Equally, my powers of observation might be incredibly astute, and you might be pensive when nobody in the room would have seen that you were pensive, but I did, and I gave you that adverb. And in this way, an adverb is very slippery. It doesn't really attach itself to one person or another. It depends on the power of observation of the person who's giving it, you know. And in that way, I think an adverb suits an omniscient third voice very, very well, because an omniscient third has a kind of authority. And if an omniscient third tells you that somebody is being pensive, then they're jolly well right, you know, because they're omniscient. They know. One of the things you notice, as you'll know, when you read literature of past centuries and 18th and 19th centuries, there's just adverbs everywhere. They were completely unafraid of them. And I think it's because they do sit much more easily in a very highly stylized context, you know, with a very strong authorial voice that isn't afraid to pass judgment on people. My favorite sentence in the world comes from The Portrait of a Lady by Henry James, and it's only three words long, and the sentence is, "Ralph smokingly considered." and I think it's so brilliant. Nobody would ever be able to write the sentence these days, but it's just in the middle of a conversation between Ralph and somebody else. And I love that he's doing two things at once. He's smoking and he's considering a point in a conversation. And the smoking becomes the adverb, and the thinking becomes the verb.
I've eaten up my time, I think. So who here would like to ask? There's a lady right at the front. She's off the blocks.
I wanted to make a comment and also ask a question. And it was a comment and a question about language. I started reading your novel, and I think I got to the second sentence, and it went on and on. And I got carried away by it. It was amazing. And I thought, how has she done this? This is the 21st century. She's so young. How on earth did she get there? And I went on. And there were more sentences like this. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant, because I spent some time years and years ago reading sort of Matthew Arnold and Walter Pater. I thought, God, their sentence structure is so interesting. Because when you get different sorts of sentence structure, you get different sorts of thoughts. And so I wondered if you could tell us about the language in the novel and about how you practice to get it right.
That's a really great question. I like the way that you've said that very much. And also that you've talked about language and syntax in the same breath, which I think is the only way to talk about. I mean, vocabulary and syntax are two parts of the very same thing. And certain kinds of syntax, as you say, produce certain kinds of thought. You know, again, it comes back to the omniscient third in a way, that subordination... a word like which or that, or, you know, subordination in general is very out of place in a first-person novel, because we don't think in subordinating ways, usually. We think in a much more plain way, in a way that kind of just gets us from A to B rather than builds back on itself. I'm a creative writing teacher at the moment at home in New Zealand, and I always say that the only three things that we need to begin with from the very beginning in the class are sentence type, sentence length, and rhythm. Those are the three things we begin with. It's amazing how when you get a class of students together, if you teach them about the three types of sentence and the different effects that you can achieve with all three of them, how instantly their prose comes alive. Of the three types of sentence, we don't tend to think or speak or act, you know, narrate in simple sentences, actually, you know, funnily enough. We tend to think and speak in compound sentences. We use and but and so, and we kind of roll these sentences on and on and on. And if you can get students to stop doing that and to kind of just get rid of them altogether, only talk simply or only talk in subordinating ways, all of a sudden they become alive to all of these tools that actually we've lost sight of in our speaking, in our speaking lives, you know. Sentence length, I think, is another amazing thing to pay attention to. You know, somebody like Henry James, you might think that he has very long sentences, and he does, but he also has these three-word sentences like the ones that I mentioned. And it's pretty much true of anybody. Like, if you open Hemingway, somebody who's famed for his terseness, he has Not only does he use all three of the sentence types very, very frequently in sculpting his paragraphs, but he also has quite an extraordinary range of sentence lengths. Pretty much every prose stylist does. You know, they make use of all the tools in their toolbox. But to answer the second part of your question, what I did in researching the book was to take as many notes as I could from 19th century novels and type them out actually into my computer, print them out into a folder, and read the folder as often as possible, and occasionally go back and highlight the ones that I thought were extra cool, kind of like two months on. And I think that actually typing out somebody else's words, especially when it's in a diction or a rhythm or when it uses language in some way that's very other to the way that you use language, is a really good way of expanding your own toolbox.
The very tight structure that really, you know, makes a novel what it is, and which is so kind of compelling, does that run the risk of being a bit reductionist in some of your characters?
When I came to kind of animate the archetypes of the Zodiac as people, I was aware of the fact that in Hokitika at this time there were around about one woman for every 10 men. So actually in the schema of the Zodiac, which is essentially 19 figures, or 20 if you count the Earth, which is the fixed point as well, I actually had a pretty accurate representation of how many women would be there. And so that was kind of the argument for having so few women in the book, which is something I've been asked. One thing that I really wanted to do with Anna particularly was to use her in order to comment on something that I had seen happen in a lot of 19th century fiction that I was reading, which was this idea that essentially that the powerful woman has to die, and most often will die killing herself. You know, she'll die by her own hand. Well, I had this very depressing week or month, or, you know, it took me longer than a week, where I read back to back. I read Anna Karenina, then Madame Bovary, and then The House of Mirth, and then lastly The Portrait of a Lady. I was determined from the very beginning to give Anna a different story, and actually from the very beginning to have everybody in the book be so convinced that she probably, as somebody who was a prostitute, she had tried to commit suicide. The other thing that I really wanted to do with her is to comment on another thing that really, really bothers me, which is the prostitute motif in literature. It's kind of slightly inelegant to talk about like that. But in a novel like the Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, there's countless examples, but you very often see prostitute characters as being these kind of walk-in, walk-off parts where they exist only as the occasion for somebody else's realization about themselves. And so the man goes and visits the prostitute, he has some revelation, she's kind of objectified either in some low way or some high way, it doesn't really matter, they're both same sides of the same coin. And then he goes off and has his adventure and we forget about her. And I didn't want to do that either. And so it was really important to me to give Anna a kind of a depth that we couldn't see, and that the 12 signs of the Zodiac characters especially couldn't see. That they think that most of them think that they love her, and they all are affected by her in a kind of a deep way. But they don't really see her. They don't. She is a prostitute for them. She is her archetype. And I kind of wanted to keep her relationship with Emery Staines private, if that makes sense, so that they could see one another, but you as the reader were kind of shut out from that. Yeah, so I hope that answers your question. That doesn't really address Lydia, though. She's a villain.
But she's great. Everyone loves a villain.
Yeah, she is modelled on somebody. She's modelled on a very flamboyant gay man that I know. and I always kind of like the idea of her as this queen, you know. You know, I tried to pay attention in the plot to the rulerships. In astrology, every sign is ruled by one of the planets. And so, for example, Balfour is Sagittarius. Sagittarius is ruled by Jupiter, so he has a special relationship with Lauderback, and so on and so forth. Pritchard ruled by Mars, so he has this kind of, he deals opium to Carver. And the one relationship that was very shadowy was the relationship of Lydia with her two constellation characters who she rules, which are Frost and Nielsen. And I kind of snuck it into the book in that Frost and Nielsen are the only two men who get tickets to the seance. But it's a little bit flimsy. So maybe she could hook up with one or both
one?
Of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, sitting there smugly, did you?
The characters openly don't care about each other sometimes, especially the two Chinese immigrants there. Most of the other characters just don't give a damn about their opinions or their backstory or anything at all, really, which I found quite refreshing in a way in a novel that, I suppose my question is, was it purely just a narrative device as for a mystery novel, or was it something that you felt was important to the setting at the time of this immigrant town in particularly New Zealand?
In my research for the book, I'd been very struck by two historical works that I'd read. The first one was a very recommendable book called The Penguin History of New Zealand by a deceased historian named Michael King. And Michael King makes the quite compelling, I thought at the time, claim in this book that New Zealand is really the most compressed version of democracy that you can see anywhere in the world, because it was the last country to be colonised in the traditional sense, and the very first country to achieve total democracy. We got the vote for women in 1898, for women and also indigenous people. This was very remarkable. And I was very pleased and felt patriotic about that. And then I read another work of history that was outraged that Michael King had made this claim and said, no, this is completely wrong because of the abysmal way that the Chinese were treated, not only in the 19th century, but long into the 20th century. And if you count the Chinese vote, which we must, actually New Zealand has one of the worst records in the world, and it was one of the last places to achieve total democracy. And that really stuck with me, the kind of the violence of this response, especially, I think, because I'd been feeling so smugly patriotic about the first book, claim. And so I really kind of wanted to show that, you know, like in lots of ways, the Chinese characters in the book have it much worse than Tofare, the Māori character. I mean, even Emery Staines, who's kind of the novel's hero in lots of ways, just completely, he has no thought for kui at all. That's the biggest theft in the book, really, is the fortune that really should belong to kui. There was actually no Chinese presence in Hokitika at that time. They didn't arrive until about 3 years later. But I really wanted opium because it's a great plot device in a mystery, because, you know, people can't remember what they did when they're under opium. And it's also a kind of disappearance, you know, again. So I wanted opium, and I also wanted to play out this double standard in a way.
I think one of the characters that's hardest to feel any warmth for in your novel is the jailer. And I wondered where he fitted in the celestial organisation. And I have another, as I've got the microphone, very, very basic plot question, which is I'd love to hear more about Moody's vision on the ship.
Well, Shepard plays the archetype of Saturn. All of the planetary characters have a little clue to what their archetype is in their name. Saturn is associated with, you know, crops and the parceling out of time. And so the idea of a shepherd kind of makes sense of that. Each of the characters have that in their name. One of the things that struck me when I was learning about astrology is how closely the seven planets align with kind of a Freudian idea of the self. If you take up Mercury, which is the unaffiliated planet, the planet that governs our language and powers of reason, each of the six that are left fall into three pairs, which can loosely be understood as the ego, the id, and the superego. And the superego would be Jupiter and Saturn, Jupiter governing our beliefs and convictions. Kind of made sense to make him a politician for that reason, Lauderback. And then Shepherd, Saturn, governing the flip side of those things, the things that we're willing to measure out and keep sight of rather than go in search of. You know, obviously the sun and the moon being the ego, the luminaries. And in astrology as well, Saturn and Mars are known as the two dark forces, I suppose. I mean, that's kind of a grand word to say. Mars, or Carver, is known as the lesser maleficent, and Shepherd, or Saturn, is known as the greater maleficent. And they lend their names to chapter titles in the book. And I really liked the idea of a kind of a lesser villain and an arch villain, Again, I'm kind of going back to the children's books that I love, and I think that the villain who's cold is always the more frightening one, and the one that you really, really don't want to see succeed. In many ways, Shepherd does succeed. You also asked about the phantom on the ship, and the way that that kind of works in my mind is that essentially there's two ways to read the luminaries, depending on your beliefs, really, depending on whether you're going to give credibility to things like astrology, like fantastical things, or whether you're not. If you believe that Staines was actually on the boat, that he'd been trapped in the case, he'd gone to Dunedin and back, and then on the way back to Hokitika, Moody had gone below, he'd busted out of the case, and then he was there. You have to also believe that the bullet from Anna's gun had gone and magically gotten to him by this cosmic force. He'd then become injured, fallen out of the boat, wandered ashore, been in the bush for a while, and that everything that Moody says then in the trial is a complete lie, because presumably Moody knows what the real situation is, or knows that that's not the truth anyway, because it's not the truth. But if you're more logical and you think that astrology is nonsense, there is another way to understand it, which is that actually Moody is telling the truth, that there was a phantom on board that was just part of his own vision, that Staines was behind the curtain in the Gridiron Hotel because he was addicted to opium. He'd been at Asuk's hut the whole time. That was why he'd vanished. That was how he got the bullet from the gun. And so it depends on what you want the truth to be, whether you're okay with the idea of a ghost or you're okay with the idea of a magical bullet.
Those of you who haven't embarked on your rereading, you know why you should, but also I think we're all equipped to do it, aren't we? We all kind of know what we're looking for, I hope. And just to thank Eleanor very much for giving us the equipment.
Thank you. Thanks, it was really fun.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.